The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Carrie Lawson from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. Our first article is in the Work and Money section. Be the mentor you wish you had. You have more wisdom than you realize. Get ready to change someone's life. If your New Year's resolution is to find a way to give back, the universe is speaking to you. January is National Mentoring Month, and although we often roll our eyes at made-up commemorations, this is a perfect opportunity to help shape someone's future. There are no set rules or guidelines for being a mentor. Oprah once described it as someone who allows you to see the hope inside yourself. Maybe you're mid-career and want to give back to someone just starting out. Maybe you're a retiree with some extra time to provide a listening ear to a foster kid. If you feel as if you have life or career experience to share, a little time to spare, and can act as a trusted advisor, congrats! You have plenty to give. Multiple studies have shown that mentoring can help mentees increase their confidence and boost their self-esteem, as well as helping to build networks and strengthen skills. But it can also provide a whole host of positives for the mentor themselves, from gaining new perspectives to sharpening leadership and coaching skills. Even without the mentoring element, intergenerational friendships have been shown to have a whole host of benefits on both sides. According to a survey by AARP, 90% of those with an older or younger friend said that their friendship offered them elements that their regular friendships didn't, including inspiration, a greater appreciation of life experiences, and new perspectives. How to find a mentee? First, decide what kind of guidance you'd like to give. You may want to find a work-related program supporting someone in your own industry, or prefer to join a youth program, offering a helping hand to a young person as they find their path in life. Maybe you want to help a child learn to read, or workshop a college essay with a teen, or give someone in your field the career-making advice you wish someone more senior had given you. For career-related mentorships, do a little research to find a program within your industry, such as Black Girls Do STEM and Create for creatives. If you work for a large company, see if it offers an in-house program. Youth mentoring can involve anything from supporting a would-be first-generation college student as they apply to schools to lending a foster kid a kind-hearted hand. Across the U.S., there are approximately 5,000 mentoring programs that help around 3 million young people. Here are a few resources we like. Find an opportunity near you. Mentor, and that's all in capital letters, is an aggregator that connects you with an extensive range of programs. The platform was founded on the premise that potential is equally distributed. Opportunity is not. Get started by filling in a brief form to see opportunities in your local community. Everything from working with school-age kids to graduates starting out in their careers, there's also an option to browse nationwide e-mentoring programs. Be a role model. The Legacy Mentor Program helps you provide a steadying influence for a young person, ages 13 to 23, in the dependency system. Rather than acting in the role of a foster parent, you'll be an adult friend, sharing life skills and listening to their stories with compassion. This type of support makes a powerful difference. Young people with mentors are 52% less likely to skip school and 46% less likely to do drugs than their peers without mentors. Support someone from a diverse background. This program introduces mentors and mentees of color for an informal relationship You don't need any special training, but you need to agree to give your mentee an hour of time a month to offer career advice and feedback, as well as helping to broaden their network. Mentors of Color also offer speed networking events to help spark connections. Get a kid into college. Perfect for college-educated folks looking for an opportunity to bolster a high school kid on their journey to college. This charity has helped almost 40,000 young adults since its inception in 1999, most of them people of color from low-income families. The results are impressive, with a 17% increase in college enrollment. You need to commit to a once-a-month meetup in person, plus a weekly online check-in. Help someone launch. LinkedIn also has a global impact section packed with opportunities from one-time sessions to ongoing engagement. There are programs designed to offer support to everyone, from college students from low-income backgrounds to military veterans looking to transition into digital careers. Give someone a mid-career leg up. If you're passionate and experienced in your industry, ADP List can connect you with someone who could benefit from your guidance. This international program covers industries from engineering to design, content writing to talent acquisition. You should have 5 or more years of experience in your industry and have experience leading junior or mid-level team members. Share your small business know-how. This one requires a substantial time commitment of 15 to 20 hours a month. But if you're retired or find yourself with extra time on your hands, it's a profound and deeply gratifying way to give back. SCORE connects people who have experience running small businesses with those just starting out in or looking to grow their enterprises. We're taking a look at Oprah Insider. Oprah shares her favorite Martin Luther King Jr. quote. Hi, insiders, and happy Sunday. I'm still in my pajamas on a crisp January morning thinking about this Martin Luther King weekend. It's been over 60 years since he shared his declaration for what was possible for America and forced our country to wake up and take a hard look at itself and make changes that were long overdue. And I realize I sit in the comfort of my beautiful home and the spaces that I share all because he had a dream. I remember standing on those steps years ago, marking the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington. It was one of the honors of a lifetime that I had describing the deep spiritual connection I felt just standing on those steps. You know, makes my eyes water. Where this great young man changed the course of history. God, he was so young. I was 9 years old when he gave that speech, and I can't help but wonder just what life would have been like were it not for him and all the brave men and women whose names we don't know who fought alongside of him for civil rights in this country. I certainly wouldn't be sitting in my warm space with a fireplace in Montecito. Who knows the kind of opportunities I would have been able to have. I wanted to share my favorite Martin Luther King Jr. quote. Many of you who followed me over the years know this. It is, "Everyone has power for greatness. Not for fame, but greatness, because greatness is determined by service." This quote from King has been a mantra for me. Everybody has the power for greatness, not fame, but greatness, because greatness is determined by service. And so I've let that lead my life, and I have found that when you change the paradigm of whatever it is you are thinking about or working on or whatever your offering is to the world, if you think about it in terms of service, it shifts. It shifts the way you look at it. And so I would like to know, as you all contemplate this day and what it means to you personally and what it means to our country, how does service show up for you in not just your work, but in your everyday life? How are you living a life of and through service? And as we honor him, I say Happy King Day. Happy King Day to you all, and go well this week. This next article is from Wellness. 13 ways to instantly be a more positive person. It really is possible to change your thinking. Chances are you've probably had someone tell you to just be positive or look at the bright side. And while they may be well-intentioned, as anyone who has ever been blindsided by a breakup, taking care of a sick family member or laid off from work will tell you, that's often an easier said than done scenario. But here's the thing. Being a positive person may have less to do with staying positive all the time and more to do with having a resilient, not to mention realistic, response. The most helpful definition of being positive is having hope and confidence in one's ability to handle what's tough, only with remembering that nothing is all negative all the time, explains Joe Eckler, PSYD, an Austin-based therapist and author of I Can't Fix You Because You're Not Broken. Instead, she defines positivity as the ability to identify sunnier takeaways or moments of relief from negative situations, which in turn may impact not only your quality of life. Studies have shown optimistic individuals tend to have better mental and physical health, but also possibly your longevity. In fact, a study published in 2019 found that people with the highest levels of optimism had an 11 to 15% longer lifespan on average than those who practiced little positive thinking. Even better, if you're naturally prone to cynical thoughts, all is not lost. There are plenty of positive thinking techniques that can help you train your brain to have a brighter outlook. Ahead, we asked a variety of mental health experts and psychologists to share their best strategies for how to be more positive, from reciting a motivational affirmation to spending time outdoors and practicing gratitude, all of which may also make you happier, healthier, and more confident. Talk to yourself through self-affirmations. According to psychotherapist and certified sex and couple therapist Lee Phillips, relying on self-affirmations can help you rewire your brain to feel more positive when you're beating yourself up over a certain experience or situation. For example, some of these affirmations may sound like, "It is okay if I have outgrown certain relationships in my life. Just means the changes and growth in our lives have taken us in different directions," says Phillips. A few more to try that Phillips loves. "I deserve to show up for myself and set a boundary when I'm getting frustrated." "I am doing the best I can right now." "I am human and I will make mistakes. It is how I respond and move forward that matters." "Rejection is hard, but it just means there is something better waiting for me." "And I deserve to use my voice and speak up about the things that matter to me." To be more positive and confident, pick a personal mantra and repeat it. Similar to self-affirmations, you can choose a mantra that can help define your view of yourself. We're often harder on ourselves than we would even be on someone else. So one trick is to talk to yourself like you would to your best friend, says Erin Parisi, a licensed mental health counselor in Orlando, Florida. Yes, it might feel strange at first, but studies have shown that talking to yourself can influence your thoughts, feelings, and behavior, especially if you're speaking to yourself in the second or third person. Think, "You can get through this," or "Jane can get through this," instead of "I can get through this." Still not convinced? To feel more comfortable doing this, try reciting a personal mantra to start your day or when you're feeling hopeless. It could be anything from an empowering statement, "I'm allowed to take up space," or "I deserve to have joy in my life," to a popular saying, "It is what it is," or "When one door closes, another one opens." Or it could even be the words that inspire Oprah, "Everything is always working out for me." "That's my mantra. Make it yours," she said during a 2019 commencement speech. Adds Parisi, mantras can bring you a smidge of relief and remind you that things will get better even if they suck right now. Then try to learn from your negative thoughts. Ever found yourself lost in a loop of worry and concern? Maybe you tend to overanalyze everything. Perhaps you're still churning over that not-so-stellar work presentation last month. That's what's known as rumination, a process in which we continually replay or dissect an upsetting event in the past, or think about the possibility of negative situations in the future. The first step is to turn your rumination into a useful problem-solving task. Instead of fixating on the problem itself, for example, I can't believe I tanked that job interview, focus on the solution. In this case, what can I do to avoid tanking the next job interview? When painful situations do arise, be kind to yourself. One thing we know for sure, you're bound to encounter some bumps in the road, and that's just part of being a human on this planet. When you do, cut yourself some slack and allow yourself to feel your emotions, whatever they may be, says Eckler. Trying to squash your stress or grief is not only unhelpful, but can also be harmful. A 12-year study conducted by the Harvard School of Public Health and University of Rochester found that those who suppressed their emotions were at a higher risk of premature death, while a 2017 study published in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology concluded that individuals who accept rather than judge their mental experiences may attain better psychological health, in part because acceptance helps them experience less negative emotion in response to stressors. Start conversations with a positive thought. Words make a big difference, not only in terms of how you feel, but also in the way others perceive you. One of the biggest ways we transfer stress is verbally, explains Michelle Guilan, G-I-E-L-A-N, if I pronounced that wrong, a happiness researcher and author of the book Broadcasting Happiness. So jump-starting a conversation with a positive statement can set a more optimistic tone. For example, the next time someone at work asks how you are, try saying something lighthearted like, I just had the best turkey and avocado sandwich for lunch. How's your day going? Instead of saying, I am so stressed and busy. This will naturally lead the conversation and your mind to a more positive place. Then not to mention that if you put out positive energy, you might also be more likely to receive it. As Oprah says in The Wisdom of Sundays, the energy we put out in the world is the energy we get back. That means if you are continually sending out negative energy through either your thoughts or feelings, you will attract that same energy back to you. According to Oprah's Super Soul conversation with Michael Bernard Beckwith. On the flip side, though, if you are able to shift your energy, you'll also attract more positivity. Practice gratitude daily. Never underestimate the power of giving thanks. In a study published in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology, participants were asked to write a few sentences each week. One group wrote about the things they were grateful for. Another group wrote about the things that had displeased them. And a third wrote about the events that had affected them with no emphasis on them being positive or negative. After 10 weeks, researchers found that those who kept gratitude journals were happier and more optimistic. To try this out yourself, spend 5 to 10 minutes each night writing down 5 things you're grateful for, from having a supportive group of friends to the decadent dessert your partner cooked, in a note on your phone, a daily calendar, or a special notebook. Additionally, you could try writing a letter to someone who has been particularly kind to you, which has also been shown to enhance happiness, says Jane Gruber, PhD, Associate Professor of Psychology and Neuroscience at the University of Colorado, and Director of the Positive Emotion and Psychopathology Laboratory. To take it a step further, expand the cycle of gratitude and kindness by texting daily positive affirmations to loved ones. Go outdoors. Spending time in nature has been shown to boost positive thinking and reduce stress, as well as increase creativity and cognition. Even better, you don't need to take a half-day hike for nature to work its magic on you. A 2019 study found that spending 120 minutes a week, or just over 17 minutes per day, exploring your neighborhood or walking around your local park greatly enhanced a person's overall sense of well-being. You can also bring the great outdoors indoors by adding plants to your home and office, or even watching nature series on YouTube, which has been shown to have similar effects. In one study, people who viewed a stress-inducing film were later exposed to either shots of nature or urban life. The result? Those who spent time taking in Mother Nature's beauty recovered from stress more quickly. To be more mindful and positive, consider meditation. Meditation won't solve all your problems, won't pay your bills, or take care of that 3-foot-tall pile of laundry. but it may help with stress, anxiety, and sleep issues. Being mindful for just a few minutes a day teaches us that everything changes, making it easier to have hope in dark moments, Eckler explains. This will also help strengthen your practice of observing, but not always giving in to the negative thoughts your brain likes to conjure. Not sure where to start? You could read these 6 simple tips from Black Girl in OMS, that's O-M, Lauren Ash, or download one of these meditation apps, or you could follow Oprah's recommendations. My advice is to start small, she wrote in the August 2016 issue of O, the Oprah magazine. When you're in the shower or tub, simply be with the water. Appreciate the fragrance of the soap. The other day I had a moment of transcendence just fully taking in the scent of my shower gel. The pleasure of the warm water and the privilege of cleanliness filled me to the point of tears. To feel more motivated, try journaling about your best self. In addition to jotting down the things that fill you with gratitude, you may also find it helpful to write about your best possible self. To get started with this writing exercise, grab a journal and start thinking about your life in the future. Pro tip: may be helpful to select a specific time period, whether that's 6 months or 5 years from now. Imagine that everything has gone as well as it possibly could, and consider what that might look like in all the relevant areas of your life, including your career, your relationships, and your health. Once you have that image in mind, take 10 to 15 minutes to write about it in detail, zeroing in on the characteristics you need to achieve that ideal, says Eckler. Give back to others. Volunteering doesn't just benefit the recipient. According to research published in the Journal of Happiness Studies, people who had volunteered in the past year were more satisfied with their lives and rated their overall well-being as better than those who didn't volunteer, not to mention that people who volunteered more frequently experienced greater gains. That's exactly why Parisi recommends getting involved with a local animal, homeless, or domestic violence shelter or a nearby school or hospital. Find the one that's right for you and you'll be routinely face-to-face with problems bigger than your own, she says. If in-person volunteer activities may be too out of your comfort zone, there are plenty of meaningful virtual volunteer opportunities you can do from your couch. For example, you can provide on-demand linguistic support to refugees, immigrants, and asylum seekers via Tarjimly, that's T-A-R-J-I-M-L-Y. You can write thoughtful cards to residents of assisted living facilities through Letters Against Isolation, or you can assist visually impaired people with everyday tasks. Think reading an expiration date via the Be My Eyes app. Practice random acts of kindness. Can't commit to a regular volunteer job? Even a small act of kindness can have a similarly uplifting effect. In a study published in the Review of General Psychology, researchers asked college students to perform either 5 acts of kindness a day or 5 acts of kindness per week over the course of 6 weeks. We found that when people carried out 3 to 5 acts of kindness a day, they experienced significant increases in happiness, Sonja Lubomirsky, and that's Lubomirsky, PhD professor of psychology at the University of California, Riverside, told us. And it didn't have to be a big gesture. It could be almost anything, from giving a friend a ride to letting someone at the grocery store get in line ahead of you. Need some more ideas? You could offer to pick up groceries for an elderly neighbor, put a coin in an expired meter randomly, send flowers to a friend, compliment the first person you speak to each day, donate blood, leave a thank you note for your mail carrier, run an errand for an extremely busy family member, pay for the cup of coffee of the person behind you in line, or leave a generous tip for a pleasant waiter. By doing something kind for a stranger, you're proving to yourself that kindness exists in the world, Parisi says. You never know when you'll be on the receiving end. Exercise regularly. A sweaty workout doesn't just enhance your athletic performance. It can also boost your mood. In fact, a study published in the Journal of Happiness Studies found that people who worked out for as little as 10 minutes per week tended to be more cheerful than those who never exercise. Plus, the link between exercise and greater levels of happiness doesn't appear to be exercise-specific. meaning you can expect to reap the benefits whether you do an online workout video or a quick yoga class while working from home or run a 5K. Parts of this article were edited due to time. Another article in Wellness, Reinventing Midlife. Chip Conley, the co-founder of the first Midlife Wisdom School, turns life's most poorly branded and longest-lasting life stage on its head. In his new book, Learning to Love Midlife, 12 Reasons Why Life Gets Better with Age, New York Times best-selling author and co-founder of the Modern Elder Academy, MEA, Chip Conley, shows us that not only have we gotten midlife all wrong, but that when reframed, it has the potential to be the richest, most fulfilling life stage of them all. Divided into sections that address the physical, emotional, mental, vocational, and spiritual, the book thoughtfully weaves the latest in longevity, neuroscience, psychology, and spirituality/mindfulness with personal storytelling, all the while debunking some of the most persistent myths. We recently caught up with Conley, who openly discussed his ever-changing relationship to his aging body, getting out of ego prison, his battle with prostate cancer, and learning to love what he describes in his book as the midlife chrysalis, which, as his name suggests, is all about radical reinvention. What have you learned about your body at this stage of life and at this particular moment from battling cancer? I have come to see that cancer is a teacher. It's woken me up to a number of things. Number one is that I didn't see my body as my best friend. I saw my body as this thing that was getting worse over time, and either it was my body's fault or it was my fault. Am I failing my body or is my body failing me? The dichotomy had me in a place of being at war with my body. I think what I've gotten clarity on is, my God, what if my body is my best friend? I'm getting old with my best friend. We're not going to look great as we get older, but you want to treat your best friend well. Yeah, that's one piece. And the chapter, I'm no longer defined by my body, really speaks to that. What a relief on some level, too. What a relief to not have to be perfect. That is, I think, particularly true for women, because anti-ageism products are really anti-women products. How have your ideas around vanity changed over the years? Well, as I say in the book, I've come to realize that this body is a rental vehicle that was issued to me at birth. We spend the first half of our life washing and waxing our rental vehicle, making it look good. If you get into your 40s, you're still trying to make it look like it was in your 20s. Yet the more mileage we get on this vehicle, the more challenging it is to have that exterior look as good as it used to. It's not to say that we shouldn't actually continue to maintain it well, but the question is, am I doing it for short-term vanity or for long-term health? I have come to realize that if I'm going to be traveling with this vehicle the rest of my life, which I will be, what's more important is how it feels on the inside, not what it looks like on the outside. Doesn't mean I shouldn't continue to maintain the vehicle or stay in shape or do a lot of things. As I also say in the book, a six-pack gets more expensive as you get older. We know how the brain develops in midlife and beyond, and that you're actually happiest at 82, which is crazy, and nobody knows this. If you knew that, then you would actually look forward to this life stage. It's a marketing problem. Talk to us a little bit about the misinformation around getting older. First of all, there's beautiful research like Daniel Levitin's, Becca Levi's, and Arthur Brooks's, and yet we do not have pro-aging messages. We have anti-aging messages. The societal message generally is, when it comes to aging, just don't do it. Becky Levi's work is so fascinating because it shows that shifting your mindset on aging has a more profound impact on your longevity than stopping smoking or starting to exercise. Longevity is also about tech bros wanting to live forever. What are the hacks? It's biohacking, or ozone therapy, or stem cell therapy. It's very focused on the physical sciences, not on the social sciences. This is what's so weird. Dan Buettner, and that's Buettner, from Blue Zones, has taught at MEA that there are 9 common variables of longevity. And they're not about actual having stem cell therapy. They're mostly social science related. How do you have relationships with other people? The 85-year Harvard study of adult development showed that the number one variable for happy, healthy, longer living people is their social relationships. That's one of 9 variables. The bottom line is, we've gotten so fixated on the physical side of longevity that we have forgotten that the psychosocial side, how we connect with other people, and how we feel about ourselves probably has a bigger impact on us, not just our longevity, but also our happiness. What's your view on the endless pursuit of happiness? Is there a difference between happiness and contentment, and what role does gratitude play in this? If you look in the dictionary, the word pursuit often has something about chasing with hostility. There's an element of something that is outside of your grasp. Then once you've got it, you realize that it was the process of accomplishing it that gave you the sense of joy. And now you need to go find something else out there. At a young age, we are socialized to not necessarily be content. To be content means you're not pushing. To be content means you tend to focus on having what you want, as opposed to wanting what you don't have. One of the keys around midlife is learning how to focus more on gratitude and less on gratification. This is not something you learn in your 20s. I think in some ways it happens naturally with age, that as certain things like the amygdala, aka the fear center of the brain, recede or go offline, other parts of the brain come forward. Talk to us about how you notice that in your own life. My amygdala is taking a nap. It's like being let out of amygdala prison, just like testosterone prison. To be a passion puppet, to be a pinball in the pinball machine is often how we feel. Then you start to realize that you don't have to be a pinball in the pinball machine. Think of Austrian psychiatrist Viktor Frankl's famous 3 sentences. Between stimulus and response, there is a space. In that space is your power to choose your response. In your response lies your growth and your freedom. Talk to us about the beauty and complexity at this age and the difference between men and women. Frankly, the real issue for men in their 50s, based on over 4,000 people coming through MEE from 45 countries, is irrelevance. For women, it's invisibility. Invisibility has an upside and a downside. The downside is obvious, especially if you're used to, as a woman, getting attention physically, maybe even in work. The upside of invisibility is you don't have to worry. There's a relief. It's a double-edged sword. Unfortunately for men, irrelevance has a big downside. But the good news about irrelevance for men, if they're open to going there, is that it gives you the opportunity to disrobe that identity in which you are irrelevant and to be relevant in some other way, whether that's being a grandparent or being a father or being a mentor or being a community builder. There are lots of other ways you can be relevant. You write about the midlife inflection point as that of turning from self-focus to outward focus. Is there a bit of liberation from the ego in the idea that you are no longer the center of the universe? The ghetto of the ego. It's not like the ego is a terrible thing. I have an anecdote that is not in the book that has come to me since writing the book, which is, in 6th grade, I went to ballroom dancing school. When you're a boy in 6th grade going to ballroom dancing school, you learn how to lead the girl in all the traditional kinds of ways. There's a lot of responsibility that comes with that. I say that in the first half of our life, the ego is leading and the soul is following. It's around midlife that all of a sudden the soul starts to lead the dance. This is not about discarding the ego or the ego going away completely. Yes, if you're enlightened, good luck, but that's not most of us. Instead, I love the metaphor of seeing that the thing that actually is leading the dance is the soul, not the ego. What it says is that the ego is still there. It's going to occasionally step on the toes of, or either one will step on each other's toes, but it's no longer leading. Because it's no longer leading, the dancing is a lot more fluid, and it's less prescribed. You get to move out of this place where you are fixated on your role and what's in it for you. I think women get there faster just because of childbirth, if they're having kids. To get to that place allows you to be in the moment and to actually experience awe. A-W-E. Tell us a little bit about the importance of awe at this life stage. Our ability to experience awe in community with other humans is enhanced in midlife and beyond because we have moved beyond our ego, and we can see the moral beauty in someone else as opposed to wanting someone to see it in us. That's when we can actually let our ego start to dissolve and let a communal joy emerge in a collective, effervescent way that's harder to do when you're younger. You talk a little bit about knowledge versus wisdom and why it's so much harder to quantify wisdom. Yeah, we live in a world that is awash in knowledge, especially in the AI era we're going into. Generally, what's scarce is often what's valuable. I think wisdom is scarce, in the sense that we have built a culture around accumulating knowledge, but we have not built a culture around how we distill wisdom. MEA is a midlife wisdom school. It has a lot to do with pattern recognition, because the longer you're on the earth, the more patterns you've seen. I would trust a 65-year-old psychotherapist or coach more than I would a 25-year-old, because they've seen the patterns in humans. Wisdom is really about understanding humans, ourselves, and others in ways that are based on experience. Our painful life lessons are the raw material for our future wisdom. Parts of this article were edited due to time. This next story is from Lifestyle. Out of devastating loss comes a healing friendship. How an intergenerational friendship and an ancient practice helped a grieving mom heal. I used to believe getting older was about losing eyesight, hormones, collagen, memory, and eventually friends and loved ones. But I've learned that what you gain from loss and oldness is the ancient privilege of becoming an elder, a person who shows the way for others. My elder story quietly took root on the dreadful morning of my oldest son's funeral. There I was, sitting in a front pew, listening to family and friends speak about our 12-year-old boy, Tommy, who had gone to sleep one night earlier that week and never woken up. We had no idea why, and still don't. Doctors think it was his heart. When it was my turn to speak, I stood in front of everyone, trying to piece together the last days and hours of Tommy's life. Somehow I knew that we all needed help and would find it faster together. So every week, starting that day and for at least a year, I invited Tommy's friends over to our home so they could process their loss together. Sometimes they came in large groups. Other times, one at a time, they sought solace in his room. They found connection in our backyard, and as they surrounded my younger son with the love he needed to preserve, they became extended family. Often the parents of Tommy's friends would come over too, and in the darkness of tragedy, my family and I experienced the power of community. A few weeks after Tommy's funeral, one of the mothers told me that her mom had also lost a child in her 20s. "My mom is in her early 80s now," she said. My heart sank as a realization set in. How has she survived this pain for nearly 60 years? I studied the woman in front of me and understood that I would do for my youngest son what her mother had done for her. I would live fully, even if I couldn't imagine how. "I'd like to meet your mother," I said, surprised by my certainty at a time when so little made sense. But the friend made it clear that the family kept their loss private. "My mother rarely talks about it." I felt embarrassed. Why in the world would her mother want to reopen her deepest wound? What I didn't know then was that my instincts were right. They were just premature. Over the next 5 years, I embarked on a journey of alternative healing, seeking out ways to mend my broken heart. Then, out of the blue, my friend told me that her mother wanted to meet. She had heard about my healing efforts and wanted to know more. "Tell me everything," she said. The first time we sat down next to each other on her couch, a tear trickled down my face. My left knee touched her right, and I stared into her warm brown eyes. "My great-great-grandparents unexpectedly lost a son at 12 years old, just like I did," I said. I was afraid to sound weird or woo-woo, but I continued anyway. "I believe it's a cycle in my family. I'm doing everything I can to heal and make sure no one in my family ever loses a child again." She grabbed my hand. "My family has a terrible cycle of loss, too. Too many children across too many generations." Our hands still intertwined. I explained that I knew in my earliest days of grief that talk therapy would not work fast or deep enough for me. Prescription medications were too costly, too numbing, and too forever. Instead, I turned to healing modalities that sparked my curiosity and resonated my spirit. everything from meditation to mushrooms, breathwork to acupuncture, as well as all kinds of ancient and modern energy healing practices. The ones that made me feel lighter, even for just for a few minutes, gave me hope that I could someday live fully and ultimately heal not just for me, but for the benefit of my family line, forward and backward once and for all. I described my practices as ancestral healing, and when I said it, I felt the true elder in her begin to stir, someone who had faced life's greatest wounds and let them crack her wide open. She smiled. I want to clean this up for my family, too. And in that moment, a friendship developed that transcended generations and ignited something in both of us that felt like destiny. It turns out that loss gave us a common language. We both believed that everything is made up of energy, just as quantum physics teaches us. We both understood, as per the first law of thermodynamics, that energy can be neither created nor destroyed. It can only change forms. So our discussion proceeded on the premise that the human spirit is energy, and therefore when a loved one dies, it can't be created or destroyed. It can only change forms and therefore remain with us somehow, some way. I explained that I had learned of other cultures, from the ancient Egyptians to indigenous peoples around the globe, with a tradition of conducting special ceremonies to cleanse the spirits of family members who pass on. The purpose is to help the spirits heal and transition from this world, and to wash away negative and unresolved energies before they get passed down to others. I told her about a shaman in L.A. His shaman works with a group of elders in Western Africa. She had been helping me clean up my family line for the past year. These elders have the ability to connect with the spirits of our ancestors, I said. I had learned so much about my family working with her and could not deny how much better I felt having done so. Sorry if I sound like a lunatic, I added, pulling back. But she cut me off. I would do anything for my family, she said, past, present, and future. She was all in. Over the next couple of months, we prepared for her first ancestral cleansing ritual. I connected her with the shaman by phone to make sure trust was established, and then I helped gather the tools she needed for her part in the four-day ceremony that would take place between worlds while she slept. I brought her new white sheets to sleep in. I gave her the healing stones the shaman wanted her to place under her pillow, and I made some ash for the bath she needed to take before bed to protect herself during the ceremony. None of this made her flinch. In fact, when I described how her dreams would change during the ritual and begin to tell the stories of her ancestors, her eyes lit up. When her ritual with the shaman finally began, I checked in with her every day to hear about them. Every night before 11 p.m., she had to take a hot bath, splashing the water on herself in a particular sequence. She also had to make a daily offering at her favorite tree. First milk to honor her maternal line, then water to cleanse, and on the final day, vodka to celebrate. All of which coincided with a specific non-religious prayer for the benefit of her ancestors. And she had to report her dreams to the shaman, who would communicate them to the elders in Africa and help decipher what they meant. The elders would then tell her how to prepare for the following evening. Throughout the ritual, she smiled with grace, roared with laughter, and transferred a mother's wisdom through the stories of her life. Sometimes we chatted for hours in person, other times through texts and quick phone calls. Despite her age and all she had been through, losing a child, being a single mother, going through a divorce, she was still curious, still growing, and still in the process of transforming. No matter how many surprises life had thrown her way, she felt blessed to make it through. A few weeks after her ritual was over, I listened as she recounted the entire experience. It quickly became clear to me that we both had changed. There was an unspoken inner peace we both felt, knowing that we had gone to the greatest lengths possible, well beyond the constraints of the human mind for our families. I'm certain that if my friend can explore her deepest wounds from the inside out at the age of 85, everyone can. And imagine how many cycles might be broken, how many family lines might be positively impacted for multiple lifetimes. Not only because we made a choice to heal, but because we didn't merely grow older. We grew into elders. Nikki Mark is the author of Tommy's Field, Love, Loss, and the Goal of a Lifetime, available now. She's also the founder and president of the TM23 Foundation, which opened the first Tommy's Field in 2021 and the second in 2023, with a third in the planning stages. Her weekly articles, Alternate Healing Toolkit, and free gifts can be found at nikkimark.com. In wellness, what all bosses should do about menopause. Cranking the office AC doesn't cut it. Here's how employers can really step up. The other week, a news alert caught my attention. Women always had hot flashes at work. Now, they're done hiding menopause. In the article, a senior lawyer described her deep appreciation when a colleague saw her suffering from a hot flash and presented her with a pretty folding fan. Hot flashes are but one of dozens of disruptions. Brain fog, headaches, anxiety, erratic periods, and urinary tract infections among them, women experience on the road to menopause that can last for as long as a decade. Truth be told, the article and the anecdote made me more irritated than inspired. Here was yet another slick story about the importance of retaining older women in the workforce that offered less than stellar solutions. A fan? Seriously? Surface-level and short-term interventions rarely meet the needs of most menopausal employees. Still, I'm glad progress is underway and that the term menopause-friendly workplace is even being used. According to the healthcare consultancy firm Mercer, 15% of large employers in the United States say they offer or plan to offer some kind of menopause support in 2024, up from just 4% in 2022. The need is growing, too. One in every five employees in the United States is at, or close to, the other side of menopause, showing up to work while potentially managing great strain on their bodies and brains. A 2023 Bank of America report, Breakthrough the Stigma, Menopause in the Workplace, found that more than half of the women surveyed said menopause had a negative impact on their work life. And there's massive financial fallout, too. The Mayo Clinic calculated that symptoms like hot flashes, cognitive difficulties, and mood swings cost an estimated $1.8 billion in lost wages per year. Moreover, menopause arrives just as many of us are catching our professional stride. Prime age of women in the U.S. workforce reached an all-time high in 2023. The average age at which women assume top roles in executive leadership? 54. Mind you, there's still paltry representation in the highest ranks of corporate America. Women hold a mere 10.4% of CEO positions in Fortune 500 companies. Managing menopause in the workplace is only one of the myriad inequities to overcome. I have often reflected on my own working through menopause story. The times when my periods were so heavy that I had to max out an overnight maxi pads and still couldn't sit at my desk for more than 30 minutes before having to dash to the restroom and change. The times I lost my temper, lost my train of thought, lost documents that I literally forgot to click save on. It never occurred to me that the experience would have been infinitely more manageable if workplace accommodations were the baseline. Not just a lifesaver for me, but also for my colleagues and every single person who relied on me. But the bigger problem is that most workplace policies barely skim the surface. In 2024, we still suffer from lack of science and investment in research. Shouldn't we be able to show up at work and in our lives free from debilitating symptoms? Don't we deserve to know more about documented racial disparities in the menopause experience? Why are we lacking clear and up-to-date guidance from the National Institutes of Health, NIH, and the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, FDA, about the safest, most effective treatments, including menopausal hormone treatment, and why aren't they universally covered by private health insurance and Medicaid? I don't want to see resources spent merely to help us fan away the hot flashes. I want us to be relieved of them altogether. Which is why I've spent the past year researching how to advance a government approach that serves and empowers women in menopause. Now that the White House and leaders in Congress have announced initiatives to advance a federal medical research agenda focused on women in midlife, including menopause, a huge breakthrough, the most impactful move the private sector can make is for CEOs to leverage their influence. This includes advocating for the newly introduced Menopause Research and Equity Act. which would mandate that the NIH evaluate the results and status of current menopause research and recommend new needed studies. And other new federal legislation, like the We're Addressing the Realities of Menopause, or WARM Act. As companies look to implement changes within, these are the kinds of robust and meaningful policies we should demand. Access to menopause-specific healthcare professionals and medical benefits. For example, offering and underwriting memberships to digital resources and telehealth menopause specialists, and ensuring inclusion of menopausal hormone therapy and other prescription options by health insurance and flexible spending account allowances. Other essential related menopause coverage includes preventative care and treatments for bone and heart health, as well as full range of mental health services. Abundant educational resources. For all employees about the mechanics of menopause, and a separate, more granular what to expect set for those who are directly impacted. Extra credit for targeted materials that address the demands of particular professions. What matters to retail workers might look different for round-the-clock direct service providers, or for women who sit at a desk versus ones who stand in front of a classroom. Ample opportunities for open-door discussion. Companies should provide expert support via a dedicated staff advocate, human resources professional, and/or health consultant. At a minimum, they should cultivate an overall environment that fosters open, respectful discourse while maintaining personal privacy. Accommodations that underscore accessibility. If we've learned anything from the pandemic, it is that the ways we work can be far more elastic and inclusive, something that disability advocates have asserted for years. For menopause, the recommendations are simple and concrete. Provision of paid health first, not just sick days, and consideration of the physical conditions and cadence of the workday, tweaked as needed for things like temperature controls, dress codes, and timing and frequency of bathroom, meal, and beverage breaks. Assurance of anti-discrimination and intergenerational engagement. From the top down and the bottom up, hiring and retention policies must address potential bias with regard to sex, pregnancy, age, and/or disability. With 4 full generations in the workforce right now, it is imperative to confront casual age bias and the knowledge gap across gender. Connectivity goes beyond cartoonish rivalries. Boomers, Gen X, and millennials can bridge a meaningful divide and bring along the new wave of Gen Z entrants. Collectively, the sooner employers take these tenets seriously and weave them into their company ethos, the sooner the rest of us can get busy reimagining and reshaping society around that knowledge, as Sharon Malone, MD, and I wrote for Oprah Daily last month. It is the path to a more equitable future, and the clock is ticking. This next one is in style. This is from Oprah's O-List Valentine's Day edition. We heart these delightful finds. So here are some ideas for Valentine's Day. It's that time of year again, and the air is heady with all things love. At Oprah Daily, we can't help falling in love with love. So we're anting up a crush-worthy curation of goodies for gifting others, or even yourself. Of course, in true O-List fashion, there's something to suit every desire. Since hearts reign supreme, there's everything from mugs and bakeware to sneakers, jammies, and even cheese and waffles with the beloved symbol. And because any Valentine's Day gift list wouldn't be complete without the traditional trifecta of jewelry, chocolate, and flowers, there are great options in those categories, too. We even have some treats to express your puppy love. All that and much more, so read on and let the good lovin' begin. Number one is Cool, and it's K-U-L-E, the 70s love tote. A tote big enough to carry a weekend's worth of stuff is always a good thing. Add some love to it, literally, and we're all in. This cotton find measures 25 inches by 17 inches and has the brand signature red and blue taping right up top. So it's a sort of a cream color, almost oatmeal color, white bag, and has the word love in green written on the front of the tote bag. It's $198 at Cool, K-U-L-E.com. Number two, Le Creuset Heart Mugs with Saucers Set. We instantly fell for this heart-shaped mug duo, and we think you will too. They're made from Le Creuset's signature sturdy stoneware and can be filled with everything from coffee to soup. Our favorite part, the saucers are also heart-shaped and great solo for serving up sweet nibbles. So there are two they're showing with a pink saucer, and then the cups are shaped like hearts as well, and then two with red saucers and cups to match. $42 at Le Creuset, and that's spelled L-E, and the second word is C-R-E-U-S-E-T. Number three, Lorette, number 57, cardigan. Lorette is spelled L-E-R-E-T. When it comes to gift giving, you really can't go wrong with cashmere. The standout sweaters from Lorette are limited edition and made with Luxe to the Touch medium weight Mongolian cashmere. We predict the lucky recipient of this cardigan will enjoy it year round and for years to come. It's $650 at LoretteLorette.com. Number four is Boom Bone Interlocking Heart Dog Rope Toy. You can play tug of war with a little extra love thanks to this interlocking heart rope toy. Ideal for smaller breeds and those pups who don't fancy chewing, they're made from natural cotton that's been hand knitted. So they look like two knitted heart ropes. One is a dark pink and the other one's red. Number five, Grant Love X Amber Saki Love Candle Holder and Chaparral Candle. Just read the brand's poetic description for the candle and you'll practically smell the melange of California sagebrush, chamomile, herbal notes, cedar wood, and geranium. Ah, if that's not enough goodness, the artful 24-karat gold-plated brass candle holder can be used over and over to light up any room. The candle is in a jar that's a peach color, and then around it is a brass gold with the words love on it. It's $175 at ambersakai.com. That's AmberSakai.com. And I think I didn't give you the price of the Boom Bone Interlocking Heart Toy, and it's $13 at Amazon. We've run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to listen next time. I'm Carrie Lawson for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Again, that website is ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. Again, that number is 919-832-5138. So long until next time. Distributed.